We're moving on to King Ahab and Jezebel, Part 5 today. I'm Dr. Fred. You're listening to another episode of Study, Grow, Know.
Welcome to Study, Grow, Know, where we discuss theology, prophecy, and current political issues from a conservative biblical perspective. Here's your host, Dr. Fred DeRuvo.
Well, thanks for joining me again. We are in the middle of King Ahab and Jezebel. This is part 5. If you're just tuning into this one, I'd encourage you to go back and pick up part 1. And also, I'd like to mention to you that you can go to Study, Grow, Know blog to read all of our past articles there. That's studygrowknowblog.com. And we've got a lot of articles for you, including this series if you prefer to read it rather than hear it. Anyway, we ended last time toward the middle of 1 Kings with Elijah's conversation with Obadiah and Elijah's assurance that he would not disappear. He wouldn't go away after saying he wanted an audience with the king. Naturally or supernaturally, he said this wouldn't happen. If Obadiah told Ahab that he had located Elijah, you'll recall that Obadiah was concerned that if he went to the king and said, "Hey, I found Elijah," and then Elijah was nowhere to be found, that the king would be upset with that and put Obadiah to death. Now, Elijah had been hiding out for some time as God fed him, first with ravens sent from heaven, and then he stayed with a widow. During that time, her flour and oil was never used up. It never went dry. There was always enough to make the next meal, just one meal at a time. And during his stay, Elijah also prayed that life would be restored to the widow's son, who had simply, all of a sudden, one time, stopped breathing due to a short illness. Now, following this, Elijah was moved of the Lord to go to Ahab. And as he did, he met Obadiah, a contemporary prophet, on the way. Since Elijah knew that Obadiah was in charge of certain responsibilities in the palace, Elijah told him, Obadiah, to let Ahab know that he wanted to speak with him. Well, at first, Obadiah was concerned that after he did this, God would secret Elijah away and Obadiah would be killed, with the king thinking Obadiah had simply tricked him. Now, after Elijah assured him that he was not going to disappear, Obadiah then went and told King Ahab about Elijah. What happens next is very interesting, and it reminds us of how many within the political field are quick to blame anyone but themselves for conditions that exist in society during their watch, so to speak. Now, when Elijah meets with King Ahab, the king is very quick to acknowledge that there are problems in Israel. He doesn't avoid them. He doesn't ignore them. He doesn't pretend they don't exist. But he's just as quick to point the finger of blame in Elijah's direction. 1 Kings 18:17b says this, "Is it really you, the one who brings disaster on Israel?" You know, isn't that like a politician? May God forbid that in this case King Ahab accept blame for the terrible conditions in Israel, because they were King Ahab's fault as the leader of Israel. Now, of course, in Ahab's mind, it was Elijah who had pronounced that no rain would fall or dew would seep up from the ground to water the plants and vegetation. So in that sense, then, yes, Elijah is to quote-unquote blame. However, Elijah would not have made that pronouncement unless the Lord had directed him to do that, and it is clear that Elijah made that pronouncement because Israel, under King Ahab's guidance, had turned away from the living God to worship his wife's favorite false god, Baal. That's not Elijah's fault. That's King Ahab's fault. Now, as an Israelite himself, King Ahab certainly should have known better, but he was far more interested in doing things his way. And part of that meant keeping Jezebel happy, so that her father from a neighboring kingdom would not hear of any malcontent attitude coming from her and wonder what was up. Maybe I need to go talk with Ahab. No, maybe I need to attack him. Ahab wanted to keep the peace, and he obviously had no real concerns about worshiping Baal. To him, it all likely meant nothing anyway. But now Elijah stands before King Ahab and is roundly blamed for the drought that all of Israel was experiencing. Elijah's retort was quick and to the point in verses 18 and 19. Here's what he says. "I've not brought disaster on Israel, but you and your father's dynasty have, by abandoning the Lord's commandments and following the Baals." Now send out messengers and assemble all Israel before me at Mount Carmel, as well as the 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah whom Jezebel supports." Unquote. That is amazing to me. There are almost 1,000 prophets of foreign gods, idols, now living in and around the palace who have, in essence, dethroned Jehovah. And King Ahab has the audacity to state that it is Elijah's problem that these things in Israel are happening. But since King Ahab wasn't backing down, it was time to show all of Israel who the real deity was. And it certainly wasn't Baal. Elijah was going to set out to prove that. And he was going to prove it once and for all. You know, I think he may have even hoped that once the victory was achieved, there might be even, at this point, a national repentance in Israel, leading to a renewal of worship of the one true God in Yahweh. Unfortunately, as we're going to see, and I'm sure you're familiar with the story, this was not the outcome for which Elijah hoped. But first things first. In verses 20 through 24, Elijah lays down the parameters for the upcoming contest between Baal and Jehovah. And before he does that, Elijah has a scolding for the people of Israel because of their continued waywardness. I find it interesting that King Ahab declined to be at Mount Carmel personally, it appears, verse 1. He simply sent the 450 prophets and sent out a message to all Israelites for them to show up at Mount Carmel. Upon looking at the gathered crowd of Israelites and prophets, Elijah gets up to speak, and here's what he says, quote, "How long are you going to be paralyzed by indecision? If the Lord is the true God, then follow him, but if Baal, follow him." But the people did not say a word. "I am the only prophet of the Lord who is left, but there are 450 prophets of Baal. Let them bring us two bulls. Let them choose one of the bulls for themselves, cut it up into pieces, and place it on the wood. But they must not set it on fire. I'll do the same to the other bull and place it on the wood. But I will not set it on fire. Then you will invoke the name of your God, and I will invoke the name of the Lord. The God who responds with fire will demonstrate that he is the true God." Unquote. Now, basically what Elijah's doing here is drawing a line in the sand, an unmistakable line that would be impossible to not see or to ignore it. It seems the Israelites, for the most part, had been trying to live in two worlds. They were either worshiping Baal only or trying to worship Baal and Jehovah. Either way, an impossibility. Elijah zeroes in on the problem by forcing them to realize that it was their indecision that had them paralyzed. It's too bad that they hadn't feared Jehovah enough to keep them from compromising their worship of the one true living God. And Elijah calls them on it. He makes things easy for the people of Israel. Elijah essentially says that if God is the one true God, then worship him. However, if it's Baal, then he should be worshipped. Which was it? Well, Elijah went about setting up this now famous contest on Mount Carmel to provide the answer for the Israelites once and for all. Seeing the results of this contest should bring every man, every woman, every child throughout Israel to their knees in repentance and recommitment to the Lord. There should be a national repentance. So Elijah defines how the contest is going to take place. It's going to be with two bulls. The 450 prophets of Baal would get first choice. They would choose one bull. They'd cut it into pieces, then place it on the wood. They would hold off and not light the sacrifice on fire. Elijah would do the same, exactly the same way. And the contest would not be between prophets necessarily, but between Baal and Jehovah. And we all know who represents Jehovah, Jehovah. We all know who represents Baal, Satan. The one who sent fire from heaven and consumed the sacrifice utterly would be declared the winner. So to this, the people replied, "Hey, this is a fair test. Yes, let's do this." In fact, it would be more than a fair test. Did Satan have the ability to send fire from heaven to consume the sacrifice? I'm fairly certain that if he could manipulate the weather to create a tornado, as he did in the book of Job, verses 18 through 19, or that he could send a messenger considered to be fire from God, verse 16 of that same book and chapter, or cause the Chaldeans to send the raiding parties on Job's ranch and livestock. I believe this all happens in Job 1. I don't think he would have any difficulty sending fire from the sky to consume the contents of the sacrificial altar laid out by the prophets of Baal. Do you? So why was Baal silent? We know that Baal, Moloch, and other false gods in the Bible are merely representatives of Satan himself. He is the power behind them when their power is shown. Why was Satan completely silent as the 450 prophets of Baal danced around, yelled, and even cut themselves? I believe it's simply because God forbade Satan to respond in any way, shape, or form during this contest. Just as God limited what Satan could do with Job, see Job 1, God put Satan in time out, essentially, where he could neither do or say anything to give even a hint that Baal had any power behind it. I'm sure it galled Satan to have to remain silent, knowing that he could send fire. But these things are reminders not only for humanity, but for Satan and his angels who follow him, that he, Satan, answers to another. And he also is under God's sovereignty and rule. And his fate is determined ultimately by God, Jehovah himself, as we know, and as Elijah knew. Now, Elijah laid down the parameters to the contest between Baal and Jehovah. Once it was agreed to, verses 25 through 29 show us the antics that the prophets of Baal went through in their attempt to get any type of response from Baal. It was fruitless. There was nothing. They danced, they yelled, they cut themselves. And by the way, this is reminiscent of an Islamic ceremony that is considered high and holy in commemorating the death of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, in 680 AD during the Battle of Karbala. Now, if you look that up on the internet, you're likely going to come across very graphic pictures of these Muslims who beat themselves and cut themselves in commemoration of this event. So please be forewarned. Now, in these types of rituals, these barbarous, brutal, and bloody acts are done to impress the gods, whether Baal or Allah. Since both are false gods, the source, Satan, is the same. During the event at Mount Carmel, Elijah allows himself a moment or two to even poke fun at the prophets. On one hand, we can understand his sarcasm, verse 27, where Elijah mocks the prophets. Yet on the other hand, this may have ultimately caused problems for Elijah within himself. Sarcasm, at its root, is a form of arrogance. You know, I've got to admit to myself that I have to deal with this within myself from time to time. In times past, I've been cutting to the bone with words and have gone for the proverbial jugular during a disagreement. I've been guilty of doing the exact opposite of what the scriptures in many places tell me how to respond, where a soft answer would turn away wrath or anger. My sarcasm simply made things worse. I've had to apologize to people because of it. And in this case, I think Elijah may have allowed the situation to make him feel as though he had the power, not Jehovah. Please understand that I want to be extremely careful here and not condemning or judging Elijah. I wasn't there. After all, as far as he was concerned, he was the only person in all of Israel who still followed and was committed to the Lord. Of course, he later learned that this was not the case, but the pressure he must have felt, and then to know that Baal was powerless before Jehovah, was probably too much for him. So Elijah took time out to mock. And I personally believe, I could be wrong, but I personally believe it led to what occurred after the victory at Mount Carmel. I certainly don't want to be hard on Elijah. We're all human. We're all fallen creatures. We have our faults, our foibles. I'm simply pointing out what occurred and possibly why. And we'll talk more about this next time, so I hope you'll join me then. But until we meet again, I pray that God will open your eyes to show you how blessed you are in Him.
You've been listening to Study, Grow, Know with Dr. Fred DeRuvo. Please join us each week for new broadcasts that deal with theology, prophecy, and political issues from a biblical, conservative perspective.